Welcome to Valhalla Conversations Podcast. I'm your host, Becky Hill, otherwise known as Soul Chaser Becky, and I am a proud Viking geek. I fell in love with the history, culture, and mythology of the Viking Age, and I have been on an endless quest for more ever since. Join me as I discuss all things Norse with those who have been inspired by Viking Age history and Norse mythology in their creative works, or those who have studied the sagas and archaeology, and review how such subjects are being presented to modern audiences today. If you like Viking stuff, you are welcome in my Valhalla, and I hope you stay for the conversation. Welcome everyone to the Valhalla podcast. This is episode 15, titled Norse Games and Vikings in Games, because there's a bit of a both one and the other. You can have games from the Viking Age, but you can also have Vikings in games. So here we are. And I'm delighted to explore this overlap of spheres, both in terms of tabletop games, card games, roleplay games, and then of course the development of computer games, two very experienced guests that I happen to know and meet in Stavanger at my academic debut all the way back in August last year. Seems a lifetime ago. And I'm delighted to welcome Emma and Luca to the podcast. Welcome, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm glad you were willing and happy to come along. Emma, would you like to introduce yourself and what your expertise is?
So I'm Emma Louise Thompson. I am doing a PhD in Viking Age mortuary identities at the University of Leicester, basically looking at what changes migration and religious change have on burial practices both in Denmark and England. I'm affiliated with the European Research Council Body Politics Project, which looks at sort of weird ways we think about bodies and people in the Viking Age. And then more relevantly to this, I've been playing D&D for 17 years or so now, sort of very much tabletop role-playing sort of gamer and video gamer, and yeah, have been thinking about how we reinterpret, we reimagine the Viking Age in tabletop.
Wonderful. And that is primarily why I brought you along. But equally, I'm sure your archaeology studies are equally interesting, because it does sound interesting. And I would certainly like...
There are board games in graves, so we can touch on that a bit later as well.
That is a really interesting point, actually. Yeah. Very well made point. We will try and remember that one, dear viewers and listeners. Luca, would you like to introduce yourself and what your expertise is in?
Yes, of course. My name is Luca Panaro. I'm also a PhD student, but at the University of Iceland, where I'm studying the modern reception of Old Norse literature and kind of the Viking Age and Old Norse myth in general, but especially in video games. So that's actually my specialization. I'm supposedly working on this database that I mentioned at the Stavanger conference. I've been playing video games my whole life, and after studying history in my undergrad and minoring or focusing in medieval studies, I became very interested early on in the modern reception of the Middle Ages in popular culture, and I had luckily cool professors who let me write term papers on these topics, so that's led me to where I am now.
That is really cool, and it's always great when someone can connect their academic interest with their passions. I certainly would love to study anything Norse related. I just don't have the time, the money, or the facilities near me, being in the west of England where I am. But anyway, that's another area entirely, dear viewers and listeners. So, Vikings and games. As you mentioned, Emma, games have indeed been around for a long time because they've been found in graves. I certainly think I may have read the odd article going many years ago about the odd grave good being a set of hnappatafl pieces, and I'm probably saying that wrong, dear viewers and listeners, so please bear with me. But I know it's also shortened to just tafl. Yeah. that's an easier part of the word than hnappatafl. It's the h in it, it's not hard. It is hard, sorry. I can't say English either.
I can't speak English literally either. For an English graduate, it's quite appalling, really. I myself have a TAFL set. I've played it with my husband, and it's a very interesting strategic battle game in that it's a game of two players. There's black pieces around the edge, and then there's white pieces in the middle, and they have a king, and the white side have to get the king to the corners to help the king escape. But the white side have fewer pieces than the black sides, and but they can all move about a bit like pawns in chess. They can go across or up and down and backwards. Curiosity, have either of you two played TAFL before?
I have not.
I also haven't, and I've always felt bad. It's been one of those things that I've included on like the here's a suggested list of what you can get me for Christmas, and no one ever buys it for me, so I've just used that as my excuse.
Right, I am sending you a TAFL set for Christmas. I will pick the one that I got from you that I can send.
I wasn't reaching, but yeah. But what I do find interesting though is some of the board game cafes in Leicester, for example, they do have it on the shelves. Like it is thought that people are interested in, some people are stocking. So it's kind of speaking to, you know, people liking Viking stuff, whether it be authentically a Viking board game or Viking inspired.
That's really good. I like that. And certainly it almost brings it full circle, because touching on computer games for a moment, of course, if people don't know about Assassin's Creed, look it up. It's a huge franchise. They've basically touched on every era of history and thus the mythology nearly. I don't think they've done the Aztecs yet, but I'm sure they'll get there.
Eventually.
But one of the earlier games, not the Japanese one that is currently out, but the one before that was set in the Viking Age and was aptly called Valhalla, because if you can't have Viking, you have the word Valhalla usually. It all has the same connection. And I remember running around as Eivor, the female version, because you can pick both one gender or the other in the game, and coming across non-playable characters, just programmable townsfolk, playing the game. Sometimes in like little rooms, like a whole little setup of different players. I thought, how cool would that be, actually, kind of like going back to the Viking Age and finding like they actually have their own little TAFL clubs.
Yeah.
Am I right in thinking that, like, it's been a while since I've played Assassin's Creed Valhalla, so I might be misremembering, but the board game in that isn't in the same as the TAFL that I'm thinking of, which is the sort of very chess-looking thing. There's sort of the little rune stones? And sort
you're
of
right, yes. Yeah. It's called, and I'm going to have to Google it on my phone, because I can't remember the name of it. But yes, they do have a game that you can play with the townspeople, and it involves... Sorry, what did you say, Luca?
No, yeah, the mini game that you can actually play, because like you said, you can see people playing, you know, a representation of TAFL, but it's a mini game that you have access to. And I never played it because I always hated mini games inside of my RPGs. I'm like, no, I'm here to like, you know, learn magic and explore dungeons. I don't want to stop and play chess. But I know it's, you know, it's a big part of these things as well. But
so
I know
when I asked Google what the game is, it's telling me about Assassin's Creed Valhalla. I want to know what the game is. That's it. Found it. Orlog.
Yes.
Which is an unusual word. I can never understand. It's a mini game. It's played with six dice. It involves dice rolls and god favors to damage your opponents, because you use these little stones as like health points almost, and you got to kind of like knock them off. And there's also drinking games and other types of mini games in this, but Orlog is one. And I have seen people either making it for custom purchase, like on handcraft sites, or do videos where they play it themselves and see if they can beat all the champions of Orlog that you meet in the towns.
Yeah,
so that's a very good point.
There's actually an article, I think, on that game Orlog by another PhD student who's studying at Helsinki, I think. Lucienne Lesauce. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but I'm sorry.
No worries. I couldn't correct you, so I don't know.
But there are also, there's another article that addresses because in the same way that you can play, you know, digital solitaire and digital chess, you can play like digital Hnepa TAFL. So, and I think there's several different versions that have tried to digitize it. So,
interesting.
There's many different ways. You don't need the board, Emma. You can just go on Steam.
It's true.
The other idea I clearly just want Becky to buy me Tafel. That was just what I was aiming
yeah,
for.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm ruining your gift idea.
But it is an interesting point that you kind of raised, Becky, in terms of people who recreate mini games from video games. I'm thinking specifically of like Gwent from The Witcher, which has become a massive thing, and people are on Etsy producing like really beautiful Gwent cards. And it's a case of, it's interesting to think of a video game recreating a historical board game that then gets recreated by someone who's played the video game, and the different sort of dimensions of interpretation.
It is. I think that's the wonderful thing about modern creativity, and especially with history and the mythological side, of course, but where there's gaps where we don't have any definitive things, that it gives us that wiggle room to say, okay, well, it could be this or it could be that, because we've got no one to say, it's wrong, because no one knows for sure. I mean, certainly thinking outside the Viking Age slightly, of course, is the Lewis Chessmen set, which is down in the British Museum still, I think. Although I think a few pieces have gone here, there, and other museums. I think one is in Orkney, where it was, I think it's Orkney it was found, or was it Shetland? One of the two is in one of the isles along the top of the UK. But even that kind of like just shows that like the love of chess. I mean, we call it chessmen. I assume they are do actually match up with a proper full game of chess, but they're all beautifully hand carved and were hidden away, and obviously someone must have loved and wanted to keep them safe from whatever was happening at the time. So it's, and then of course people do get buried with games. Of course, we don't really bury anyone with things these days, but gosh, imagine what a dungeon master these days would take to make grave ever, like how many manuals, how many packs of maps, all the tokens.
I always talk about how like when I die as an archaeologist, I just want to be buried in the weirdest way possible to confuse future archaeologists. And I think just being buried with all my dice might do a lot for that.
That's a good point about dice, because that made me think of a guy called Adam Blueaxe. Go looking up on Instagram. Oh, you've got some.
I always have dice ready.
I've just literally put all my D&D bags upstairs. I mean, that's where I forgot to bring all my many Viking-inspired D&D source books down, but my husband's not having an app, so I can't. But I have got many, dear viewers. I have got many. But sticking on the issue of dice, Adam Blueaxe is a brilliant artifact recreationist smith. He learned all the ways of making them, and he also kind of like, he showed up these tiny little polyhedral weights, because of course they use as dice that we used as weights back then, and they keep saying they look like dice, because we call them the D&D weights because they could be used, you just need to put numbers on and then you can use them. Because of course some weights have been found that look remarkably like dice. And speaking of dice, on a slight topic, I remember when there was a great exhibition travelling around the UK to do with the Torksey River Camp that was found, and the hundreds of dice that they found. How many people were losing dice in that camp? It was countless, because they lost so many, and they were all in different shapes and sizes and had different ways of marking the numbers on. It's just, I think a Norseman would appreciate us dice goblins and the D&D community with all our dice.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're just slowly finding the origin of the dice goblin.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly remember coming across, ironically enough, on Threads, which isn't a platform I visit much. I should do, because I know it's got some people I like and follow on there. Someone posted a photo of a Roman dice tower, and it had a Latin inscription around the top, something along the lines of, "We've won victory against the Picts, now let's drink and play games." And it is exactly like the fold-out dice towers that you get in most D&D shops. And of course, I kept thinking, Romans playing D&D. Where would their imaginations take them? What stories and adventures would they have? Would they be playing with the Greek or the Roman gods, I suppose. It's just games and play. It's such a human thing. And the sort of having a game with rules and tactile things, such as dice or cards in the form of Gwent, is certainly an ageless thing, as ageless as storytelling in a way, I think. And especially with the game of not sorry Orlog, but certainly Tafel, with it being a strategic game and almost like a battle, it just shows the kind of mindset that these people must have had and who was trying to play these games, because they probably weren't well, they were probably cheap to make if you could just have a piece of wood and just carve some lines and then get some random rocks. But other like proper nicely made sets, obviously for the upper class, those who could afford it, those who had maybe high goals or esteemed or who knew nobility or had people and family who were warriors and had to go out and protect the kingdom and defend the king and queen and whatnot. I certainly would love to know how many tafl sets there are out now in graves now. I would love to know a number because I don't know how many has ever been found. It's an interesting one.
So keeping in mind that I obviously specialise a lot in Denmark, there's definitely one in Jutland, which is the mainland of Denmark, which was found with what they thought to be, an adult woman. But again, grave goods and gender in the Viking Age is a bit of a tricky subject in the sense that we assume jewelry equals women and, you know, swords equal men, but isn't always the case. But this particular grave was some jewelry and a gaming board. And then the other sort of main example I can think of is the big Birka burial, which was believed to be a male warrior, was resexed as a female. So she had a gaming board set with her, and it's often believed to reflect kind of not necessarily like military kind of power, but sort of that kind of strategic thinking of this person was important to kind of the local community. But it's obviously a hard one to read into because it is also play, right? So it doesn't have to be this military sense just because it's in a grave. So we can sort of unpick that in many different ways.
Yeah. In a sort of literary example as well, I always forget the name of the actual poem, but in Orkney and Gataga, sort of the poem that the Earl of Orkney and his one of his courtiers essentially composed in tandem mentions these kind of valuable skills that they both know, and one of them is knowing how to play Hnefatafl. So it clearly also had sort of like a Game of Kings kind of connotation, like chess does as well, and did for many years. So but yeah, the fact that it's in these sort of particular types of graves, definitely like elite, but some sort of like military strategy, like not just a rich warrior, but like somebody who knew how to plan. Very interesting.
I guess because they certainly have a game like this, you must have the time to learn how to play it and then play it, whereas a lot of the common folk might have been too busy just surviving, living, farming, crafting, sailing, raiding and doing everything else that the common folk of the Viking Age time might do. I can't remember now if the Jorvik Viking Centre have got even scratchings of what could have been used as a tafl board on any of their wooden pieces, unless I'm thinking of something from the British Museum exhibition that they did. Oh my gosh, at least 10 years ago now. It seems a lifetime ago. I'm sure I remember something like that. I could be wrong. My memory isn't the best at things.
It's an interesting point, though, because I think it's not a case maybe that the common folk didn't play games, but maybe the material of the games was different. So if they're just sort of scratching into the mud, for example, that's not going to last in the archaeological record, whereas someone who has money to, you know, create a really nice board, we're more likely to see that. So it's not so much that they didn't play it, just maybe they played with different material.
Yeah. Wood especially.
Yeah.
Does not last.
Not at all.
I don't suppose either of you would know of any other type of Norse or medieval type game that might have been around or perhaps at the time besides tafl. Because I certainly can't think of any.
I mean, in the sagas, of course, we have, not board games, of course, but we have like sports references, but as far as like board games, which is obviously the topic, I don't think there's anything. There's the really obscure reference in Völuspá to the random, you know, golden gaming pieces that the gods play with at the beginning.
There is.
And then after the sort of rebirth of the world, after the final, you know, the true final battle, they find the gaming pieces in the grass again, and sort of the good times come back, but they're just golden gaming pieces. It doesn't say which game or what they're doing with them. Just
that
the idea, like, of play, like you say, just the idea, the concept of having the leisure time and these kind of delightful, you know, having enough gold to just make game pieces out of and throw them in the grass, apparently.
that's a very, very good point. Completely forgotten about it being mentioned in the whole kind of pantheon arc of the end and rebirth of the world. That is a very, very good point.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll just stick with Tafel, because we know that's definitely existed and been around and was played out with Vikings, and it's been around for a while. I guess, Emma, what can you remember when the first time you came across anything Norse or Viking-y in your D&D experience?
So I think it's interesting because the Norse gods have been in Dungeons & Dragons since pretty much Dungeons & Dragons started. So Dungeons & Dragons released in 1974, and they did a supplementary materials book in 1976 where they said, hey, you can use the Norse gods if you want to. So they've kind of been embedded into D&D from the start, and then actual kind of campaign settings for the Vikings have been around since like the late 80s. So it took a little while for them to get their own thing, but yeah, they've been in there from the start. But in terms of, I guess for me, it was something I started thinking more about, I guess, with loads of the video games coming out around a similar time after the Vikings TV series, but also you had the kind of campaign module Rime of the Frost Maiden, which is an Icewind Dale setting for Dungeons & Dragons, which is very much the frozen tundra of the north, and you can kind of make that as Viking coded as you want to. So I ran that campaign, and just being a Viking person was like, well, here is my snowy landscape to throw all my Viking lore at everyone. So that's kind of where I started thinking about it.
That's a very good point about how certainly a lot of the references that I've come across to tied to Norseness in both computer games and tabletop games, they always seem to come from a very cold climate.
Why are the Vikings never,
I mean, even it? Yeah, they don't just come from like anywhere like around the UK where it's the weather's more temperate and mild, stormy perhaps weather. You might actually have summer. I mean, they probably did have summer more reliable than we do today. The seasons were much more tamed and regular back then, without industrialization meddling in. I know very recently in my own personal D&D experience, I played a fighter who I made distinctly Norse with the name of Bryn. And then I tried to give her the name Van's daughter because I was trying to mix Vanir and daughter together. But that was me messing with linguistics. But whenever she gets asked about where she comes from, she always says, I come from the icy fjords and the snow-capped mountains. So as far north as you can possibly go. That's where she comes from. It's not just so like not just from Harbour City or even kind of started there but grew up somewhere else. Kind of thing. That's a really good point. Certainly some of the expansions, well, not quite the expansions, but like little add-on supplements that I got, without being hardback bound, usually the PDFs, they often kind of highlight that coldness. They give them more fur, they give them cold resistance and kind of like ice damage and all sorts. And there's a very much connection with cold and Vikings for some strange reason. And I don't know where this stems from, but it just seems to stick as much as the horned helmets do.
Yeah, I think, I guess, because in this is maybe overgeneralizing fantasy, but I think the point is that we tend to be a bit more kind of categorical in the sense of, in a lot of fantasy novels, it's like, here's the icy country and here's the desert country and here's the kind of rainforest country, and it's a case of it homogenizes cultures quite quickly. And I guess the Vikings are a very easy allegory for, you know, frozen north if you want to look for kind of inspiration. I even just thinking of like Rime of the Frost Maiden, the Icewind module, even though it doesn't code itself as Viking inherently, when it's like, here are the suggested names for people who live in Icewind Dale, it's like Astrid, Brynhild, you know, Joffers, and it gets very Scandinavian very quickly. So they're kind of leading you down a path, even if they're not forcing it on you.
Yeah, actually a question about that Rime of the Frost Maiden. Maybe it's just coincidence, but is that based on like Robert Howard's Rime of the Frost Maiden? I'm pretty sure it's, he has like a Norse,
the
first like true Viking short story.
I would imagine
called like Rime of the Frost Maiden or something like that.
I would imagine there are links to that. I would also imagine it's partially referring to the Snow Queen by Hans Christian Andersen as well, because there's a lot of that kind of mythology to it, which obviously isn't inherently Viking, but is very Scandinavian.
Yeah, I mean, this is all touching upon what we were all kind of talking about after Caroline's keynote about the boreal medievalism, about the different ideas of just the North. So it's not, it doesn't have to be Viking coded, but if you've got some fjords and snowy mountains, people are kind of going to expect to see Vikings come sailing around the corner at some point. I'm pretty sure one can reasonably argue that the association does come from like 19th century German philosophy, apparently, especially concerning, you know, the old annoying holdover about, you know, hard climates make hard people. And of course, the idea of that, you know, Scandinavia is quite cold, at least for half the year, even though it does become green, even though some people don't believe it. And so that sort of just became crystallized as like, it's always cold. And it's made them like extremely grim, you know, sort of eager to go south and raid and pillage and take. So this kind of old holdover from 19th century philosophy and ethnography from back then, you know, and it's just stuck ever since.
That's a good point. It's quite remarkable how much kind of like the impression or the mindset has been fixed on stuff that was created or written about centuries ago, and it still repeats to this day kind of thing. And especially in terms of Vikings, of course, I mentioned horned helmets. We all know, just to clarify, viewers and listeners, it's a Victorian invention. Blame Richard Wagner, but also blame his costume designer, Emil Doppler, because I know from my research that it was his choice to put the horns on the helmets. Yes. And even I've heard Dr. Yanina Ramirez, who is a historian idol of mine, she's kind of said it was just purely so they could be seen from the back of the stage. That's all it was. and I'm actually going to see the Valkyrie iteration of it from the British Royal Opera tomorrow. I will have seen it by the time this episode drops, but I am seeing it right after this recording. They're showing it at cinemas across the UK, so I don't have to go all the way down to London to see it.
Okay.
A good 5 hours long.
So. Yeah, I was going to say that's going to be quite long.
And it's my first ever opera, so it's going to be a whole whirlwind of an experience.
Very cool.
The costumes are very 20th century, very 20th century from the preview images I have seen. So it's going to be interesting. Thankfully, they are providing subtitles. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a clue what anyone's saying besides characters' names. That'll be it. What I was trying to say was, in terms of D&D games, I guess, more to catch up on your point, Emma, about categorization and... Yeah. Of course, it does link into how fantasy writers have depicted worlds and set the tone. I can certainly think that maybe perhaps historically, with kind of Anglo-Saxon England being around for so long and often being kind of like the lowlands, the green pastures, the marshes, the rivers, the shores, they almost kind of like have claimed that fantastical terrain for themselves. It can't ever be Norse, it's going to be medieval / Anglo-Saxon age-ish or Renaissance or any other period but Viking, even though we had Viking York for hundreds of years and they lived there and they spoke Norse as well as Anglo-Saxon and everything else in between. It's like they don't often acknowledge that when these cultures do it coexist quite happily together and have done, and that's how the Vikings survived, because they just amalgamated into everything and everyone, basically.
This is pretty much the entirety of my PhD, in the sense of, for a very long time, the question in archaeology is, why can't we see Viking burials in England? Because we see kind of more stereotypical examples up in Scotland, or we see one or two in England, but not a lot. And it's a case of, well, there are more interesting questions. If we're not seeing stereotypical Viking burials, that says a lot about how the cultures kind of commingled. And also, I would also argue, what is a Viking burial is actually not as stereotypically convenient as we want it to be. Like, I obviously do a lot of Danish burials. There are people in the project who do a lot of Swedish burials. And they will frequently say, oh, you know, most people in the Viking Age were cremated. And I'm just in the corner going, not in Denmark. So it's very easy to fall into, I guess, stereotypes without, you know, actually having as much evidence for it as we think we do.
And the Viking Age was a long period and lots happened, right. Lots of invasions, colonization, settling, raiding, pillaging, and of course fighting in between everyone else as the Vikings came along. So of course I keep thinking back to, of course, Ethelred the Unready, and how he triggered a bit of a thing with Sweyn Fortbeard when he said, let's kill all the Danes, we don't want them here, let's eradicate them. And then, but that just proved that there were that many happily settled, living and working in various ranks of society, assumably, that he obviously decided it was a bit too much for him. Uh-huh. For some reason or another.
But as a Dane, Danes can be quite a lot, so I understand people wanting to get rid of the Danes. I can say that because of British.
But yeah, but of course, speaking, that brings back to your point, kind of like, what is Viking? Of course, everyone used the word Viking, but it's not a particular person or country or origin, because the whole of Scandinavia was different feuding kingdoms for ages before Sweden became Sweden, before Norway became Norway. Denmark was kind of always Denmarkish. It just didn't have the name Denmarkish, because there's bits of pieces of Ireland like Jutland, as you say. So they were as fractured as the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms were. So of course unification, and then the fact that they are now three countries and not just one giant one. And I think I now have come across it in certainly some historical fiction that I read, that kind of like, if a Norseman gets called Danish or Swedish, he finds that very insulting, and equally vice versa. They don't like being labelled the same authenticity or origin, I should say. Sometimes I have come across actual characters in books playing Tafel, but actually not as much as I think, mainly because they're often too kind of like dramatic and lots of adventures and sailing and raiding and trying to survive and whatnot and that kind of thing. But it's an interesting one that I think maybe should be looked more at as historical fiction writers. And certainly game writers definitely do, both in tabletop and of course into computer games, which tabletop heavily influenced. And you can probably tell us more on that, Luca, I believe.
Sure, yeah. I mean, just the basics, which Emma probably is already very familiar with. Everything sort of started with these, you know, tabletop miniature war games, which then became D&D when they mixed in kind of Tolkien-esque Howardian and Lovecraftian kind of science fiction and fantasy fiction, and, you know, reduced the size from armies to the party, just like the Fellowship. And then very soon after, computers became, even when they were only the purview of research institutes and military infrastructure, people were already playing around on these huge fridge-sized clanging computers. But once computers also, you know, became more widespread, especially on university campuses, people immediately started using them for gaming and figured out very fast that the type of numeric basis of any sort of tabletop games fits very well when you can have the computer just do all the calculations instantaneously for you, and leave sort of the more interesting kind of role-playing aspects up to the player to sort of just enjoy without worrying about all of this annoying mathematics. And so there's a direct line into, I mean, the CRPG or computer RPG is like a kind of main pillar of the history of video games in general, because these are some of the earliest games where these text-based adventures, so even before you had a visual output in the form of a screen, you had these, there were screens, of course, but not the type of screens we think of that were able to display image, but purely just text. You had these text-based adventure games like Colossal Cave Adventure, or just called Adventure for short, which was directly based on Tolkien's Legendarium, Middle-earth saga stuff, but in the form of this text-based CRPG that handled all the dice rolls and stats for you and things like this. So they're very closely aligned and still are.
Very much so. I think any computer game that has a hit point bar just has D&D to thank the word hit points.
Yeah, exactly. They say health points sometimes, but we know what they mean.
And of course, most viewers and listeners may be familiar with, of course, Baldur's Gate 3, which is entirely D&D just as a computer game. I haven't. I think I remember playing the early Baldur's Gate many, 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 many moons ago. Very vague memories of it. And I think we might have done Baldur's Gate 2. Have yet to touch on Baldur's Gate 3. I mean, I haven't completed Assassin's Creed Valhalla, ladies and gentlemen. So this is how much of a backlog I have in gaming.
Who has?
Infinite Valhalla is massive. I remember completing all of Norway and being like, excellent, right. And then you get to the England and I went, oh no. The completionist in me is crying.
Oh God.
Well, see, if anything, when I was playing the first bit where she is in Norway, I kept trying to deliberately try to find the edge of the map just because I was like taking photos. The photo mode is what got me. I spend more time either role playing or doing the photo mode, trying to get lovely action shots, beautiful scenes, screen backdrops for my computer. And of course, I'd eventually hit the barrier of the game and say, nope, you're going to go back into your 21st century character. And I'm like, no, I want to go back to being a Norse woman. Thank you very much. So besides Assassin's Creed Valhalla, of course, which has made a number of headlines when it came out for various reasons. Another very successful game that has adopted the Norse mythology, certainly, of course, is the revived God of War games, which began anew in 2018, because that took their Greek hero, or anti-hero, depending on how you view him, and decided to plumb him straight in a world of Norse mythology, which I think was a very, very bold move. I don't know who did it, but they hit the nail on the head well, because everyone loves it. Unfortunately, I can't play it because I don't have a PS4. So my mere glimpse of it was watching by my brother, and it was usually when he was battling the Valkyries or learning, telling me about how Atreus is now Loki, and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. If he has a sprig of mistletoe, I can tell you what he's going to do with it if you want me to tell you.
Spoilers. No.
But yes.
I was about to say something. Because I did write an article on 2018 God of War, the first Norse one, and I did find out that it kind of came down to a split decision, because it had been a whole 5 years since the previous God of War game had come out, mainline God of War 3, and so they're like, okay, we gotta kickstart the next console iteration of God of War. What should we do? Like, we've had, I think in total, including the side games, there was like 11, I think, God of War games. So it's all about, Kratos, this Spartan, semi-divine anti-hero at times. They're like, okay, this has been done to death. Like, we either have to change the character or we have to totally change the setting. And they were like, well, we can't get rid of Kratos, even though he would love nothing more than to be put to rest at some points in the game, so they totally redid the setting and chose Norse mythology because it was very in vogue at the time, even when they started developing the game, because it came out in 2018 and it was about a 5-year development cycle. In 2013, you have to think, obviously, the Thor movies were already coming out, Game of Thrones was in full swing, Vikings had also just started, I think, in 2013, so they were. These things were already in the air. Skyrim, obviously, everyone was obsessed with Skyrim still, and still is, or at least I still am.
For you, I mean, I keep hearing things about Skyrim, but again, I, as a parent, I lack the time and the energy. I have a long list of games, and I think I'll play them when I retire. That's what I'm keeping them booked up for, when I retire.
To add more games to your list, though, both the God of War games, the recent ones, are on PC now, so you have no escape.
The thing is, I'm rubbish at the kind of like the hack slash and dodge. No. I'm rubbish at dodging. I can hit things and run, or I can shoot from afar.
my ex used to get really annoyed at me because he was just like, Emma, the parry button exists, and I'm just like, no, that's not my play style. I just hit things. So you can play it and just hit things. It's just not as effective.
Yes. I mean, even in Assassin's Creed Valhalla, I'm still kind of like just endlessly hitting things until they stop hitting me and then running away as soon as my health gets too low.
Valid.
It's like how in Pokemon, there are obviously things you can do to like weaken the other sort of Pokemon, which aren't just hitting it. But it's like, it's more fun to just hit it with the attack. I don't want to drop its special defense.
No, no. I want to see the big numbers.
Yeah.
They make my brain happy.
So we've talked definitely about, certainly on the big three, Skyrim definitely being one of them, because I remember your presentations to Banger and it was really insightful because I have no clue about Skyrim, so it was lovely learning about the Draugr and the undead and the zombies there. Certainly I think in terms of games, certainly from the ones that I'm able to access thanks to my brother's extensive Steam library, a lot of them seem to be touching more on the mythological side than the historical, which I think just works quite well for creative purposes, because then they don't have people emailing them saying, no, you've got the mooring horned helmets and they're doing that wrong. And I mean, that's the one bugbear I have with Assassin's Creed Valhalla, that you way you mine ore is by hitting a piece of ore with your weapon, which is defeats the purpose, because in reality you would break the weapon and you wouldn't get any ore to make a new one. And I think personally, it almost like it skips over the fact that there must have been a mining industry of some type around in reality in that time to enable all these weapons and jewelry and stuff to be made. Otherwise, where are people getting the metal from?
Yeah, yeah. It did not faithfully represent bog iron, the importance of bog iron.
I think someone needs to invent a Viking mining game. Or just a historical mining game and see how far in history you can take your mine.
I was going to say, I haven't played it, but I think Valheim, although it's supposed to be kind of like that more kind of Viking sim kind of game than some of the others.
I might be wrong,
but that was the impression I got from Valheim.
Yeah, I've actually played a lot of Valheim. it was a perfect storm to come out in March of 2020. I think, like middle of COVID basically, and my friends and I got really into it, and the interesting thing is to look at it as a game, a Viking game produced in the Viking boom period that we're in now, but by a Swedish game studio, and you can really tell. I did like a term paper, so it's not published, so don't steal my idea. No, that's fine. But looking at the actually the landscape archaeology in the game, because it has, every game from everywhere has, the Vikings had runestones. Everybody knows that. But not everybody knows that the Vikings also lived, alongside Neolithic dolmens, stone boat settings like in Gotland, and several other kind of like historical grave types that predate the Viking Age, but were still there in the landscape. So you could really tell that these are Southern Swedes from Skövde, so they knew what the landscape looked like. They're like, well, we don't have to make up a Viking landscape. They put some fantasy elements in the game, but they live in the Viking landscape technically. The interesting thing about that game is there is like a tech development where you start with, stone and wood and move through different types of material. And when you find iron, it's in bogs. So, but only in crypts full of Draugr. So.
Of course, nothing's easy,
Ryan.
Yeah, you do have to work for it. Takes a long time.
I remember playing a game that came out that hasn't done as well, and for life of me, I don't know what it's called. But I only came across it because one of my favourite historical fiction writers, Giles Christian, and we will touch on him again because he's doing work with a better, much better game now. That was a survival-esque game set in kind of a very North-esque historical world, but it was one of those deep mine farming type survival games where you have to get the plants and get the fibres to make the cloth to make your clothes. And if you don't do it quick enough, night falls and you get too cold and you freeze to death. I learned that quick. Beyond, as well as starvation and food and thirst and running into random bears. But it was very basic in its animation style. It wasn't as basic as kind of like Minecraft, but it didn't have like a smooth CGI look. But it was tricky to survive in. I didn't get very far with it. And even though I know there was a whole island to explore, including Graves with Jauger in. I never got the fight. I didn't get enough clothing together to get a full set of armor together. I kept thinking I'm constantly just dying eventually. I get a little bit longer, but it was just never good. But he is now working on a much better game with a simple title. Oh, well, I say simple title. They've announced the full title now because the teaser trailer that's officially out there is called Norse, / Oath of Blood. And thankfully, he's the lead writer on the whole narrative and character of it, and he's doing wonders. And having kind of like read the blurb of it, it has such strong echoes for his Sigurd the Lucky historical fiction series, starting with God of Vengeance, which I highly recommend everyone read before they go play Norse, because it's got strong echoes of it. But that looks more historically accurate to a degree, possibly more than Assassin's Creed Valhalla. It's a turn-based combat game, and there is combat. I'm thinking there is some kind of, not say role play, but certainly dialogue options in it. We don't know much more. They're still in the early development phase, and they are actually putting a call out for players to come and test it. Unfortunately, I don't have the time, otherwise I would. Plus, they kind of ask for your CV on other turn-based games, and I really struggle to think of what turn-based games I've played recently, if at all. It's a computer game. But that's Norse, and that's hopefully coming out later this year at some point. They haven't set a date on it yet. They're just saying 2025 at some point. It's looking at 2025. But I'm really looking forward to that, because I've seen some of the motion capture they've done behind the scenes, and plus I like jazz anyway, so I'm kind of biased in all regards. plus it's Viking, so it's going to get my money at some point. But some other games that I've played with, which one should I think of? Oh, the one that I've been playing recently and that I mentioned just before we launched fully into this episode is called Atone, Heart of the Elder Tree. It's again doubling with the Norse myths. It's very artistic and linear in blocking style. The music is stunning. It just whisks me away every time. But interestingly, they've done something really, I want to call it odd, with the way they're presenting the Norse myths, or at least the gods in some aspects, in that their world is where the gods were there, and then they left because humanity did something wrong, and they keep calling it the sin. Humanity's sin. I'm like, sin is such a Christian word, and it feels wrong to put it with these gods in it. But I will say this, that in my last playthrough, I did come across a vulva, which always makes me happy, because it's nice to see kind of like either shield maidens or seeresses. Usually they're the two common female types, and of course shield maidens are propping up all over the place, or at least having female characters that can do just as much damage as the boys, and they're not just screaming in the background, running around, or having crying babies and whatnot. But that's an interesting game, not just because of the way they presented that Norse gods, but it's a role play, kind of like very light role play, in that you do get options, but you don't really get told if it's a bad choice or a good choice. You don't get to see the effect, like of course, like in Dragon Age, for example, you can say so and so disapproves, so and so highly approves. You kind of get friendship points, or you lose friendship points. But once you've made that choice, it's done. That's it. But the combat in it isn't typical run around with a sword and a shield or an axe or a spear or even a bow and arrow. It's based on pressing numbers on your keyboard. I was going to say keypad then. That was the wrong word entirely. Set to a beat in a rhythm, because it's a music-based combat. And so you have to spend a lot of attention trying to get the right rhythm right in order to fill up this meter, and then something happens. Although you're usually still focusing on the meter filling up again, so you don't miss actually see the action when it happens, because it's all happening there on screen. But it's really well done, and I remember following it when it first came out, but when it first went to Apple Arcade originally, and only in the last year or two has it finally made it onto Steam, and I have a game laptop so I can play it. But I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes, because there's something to do with magic and the gods disappearing, and how this person needs to work out why people keep turning blue and going crazy and then killing each other. That's as far as I've got, so I can't give any more spoilers besides that. Oh, there is a talking frog, which I find really amusing. And the character quite rightly says, like, why are you a talking frog? Why are you talking to me? What's going on? What is this madness? And I'm like, quite right, I would say the same thing if I met a talking frog. But in terms of, are there any other computer games that you two would recommend or can think of in terms of Viking Norse representation or experience?
I mean, one sort of small independent one that I've been playing recently, which is kind of a bit atypical in the Viking space, is something called the Frost Rune. And it's basically a point and click murder mystery. So you arrive on an island, everyone's dead, the gods seem to be involved, curses seem to be involved, and you just sort of work out what's happened with some help from the gods here and there and sort of things like that. There's no real dialogue, it's sort of very low key, but it's been quite an interesting sort of short story. And I think it's an interesting, I guess, subversion to all Viking sort of media has to be violent. So it's just a fun little murder mystery on the island.
Good. That's interesting. That is also on my wish list. I have actually got it. I just haven't played it yet because I thought that seemed really, really interesting.
Yeah, the art's really like beautiful as well. So it's very, very well done and just yeah, just small and on kind of the periphery of the Viking game world.
I was toying with creating some kind of master list of Viking games, especially using Steam as a research platform because it's where most people publish everything. And I quickly found that searching either term, Norse or Viking, comes up with hundreds of released and upcoming and early access titles. But I did start making the list, and the Frost Rune was one of the ones that I
It's very
logged on there. So
yeah.
one that I keep meaning to play because a good friend of mine, who also has a degree. Is a PhD in Norse, Old Norse stuff in our wheelhouse, is the Banner Saga trilogy. Comes highly recommended from her. And I've read about it just to kind of get the gist of what it's about. And it's sort of like a rewritten, kind of fantasy blend that's mostly Norse flavored about, like an encroaching, corrupting force and different clans of sort of Norse inspired beings have to humans and these sort of Jötnar type beings have to band together to defend themselves from this sort of ontological void enemy. And it's also like the Frost Rune, it has this beautiful like hand painted artwork style.
I think I tried it once and I didn't get very far because there's a little combat you experience right in the beginning and I don't think I survived it.
Oh,
And I thought, oh,
okay.
I'll just put this one to the side for a bit. I'll come back to it later. But it's
So
a high mission
it's
from what
what? It's
the
like
Jötunheim.
a tactical
It is.
RPG, I think. So you
It's
have to be.
almost turn-based to a degree, I think. It was
Okay.
a long time ago, I think it was back
Yeah.
before my daughter was even born, which was at least 4 years ago.
Got a very good soundtrack too. I haven't played it, but it's on all
That's
my like
true.
Norse themed take
Yes.
soundtracks.
Yeah.
I'm just like, Banner
It's
Saga
beautiful.
on there.
One that
There's
I
another
have
game on
played.
my wish list, which is
Go
called
ahead.
Dead in Vinland,
Say
which I
it.
don't know if you've heard.
Yes.
Dead in Vinland.
Yeah.
It's another mystery game. It might be up your street, Emma, if you like Frost Rune, because that's purely about this shipwrecked family on Vinland and survival and strategy in terms of choices and resources. There is some combat because as you explore, you come across other characters and they're of course not always friendly, but there's some magic and mystery involved as well from what I've seen in the trailer. And I keep thinking, oh, that would be really interesting because of course not many people think of Vikings then put the word Vinland together, just like not many people think of Vikings put the word Iceland together, but then they kind of the spread of Vikings and Norse in reality is quite much further than just kind of like Scandinavia and England. Most people forget about Scotland and the Picts
Yeah.
and the Hebrides and the Shetlands, of course, Ireland and the Isle of Man. And I keep saying I'd love to do a world tour and just join all the dots together and go to where all the Vikings have been, because it would cover at least half the world and all the way across to the east. But yes, Dead in Vinland looks like an interesting one. And in terms of you mentioning, of course, the Jotuns in the Banner Saga. Giants are such a common Viking character type that's come across in a lot of any Viking games. I know another one on my wish list is simply called Jotun, and it involves a woman
Yeah.
who couldn't get into Valhalla and she has to go around killing all the giants. And thanks to my brother, because I can see what games he's been playing, because we share the Steam library together. I know he's just been playing, or fairly recently, in fact, another game that's come out literally fresh this year, I think, called Svartalfheim, Battle Against Hell or Hell's Army or something like that. And it's just where you go into the Dwarven realm and kill lots of hellish things and get godly powers. And they have some class types. They have Berserker, they have CRS, they have some kind of Ranger type, I can't remember the name of it. And they have Flame Daughter, which is where you're kind of like you're half torch, human torch, but not kind of thing. Just half magma and lava and fire, but the half is flesh. So it's interesting that that's the kind of female fighter type that they've given compared to the Ranger, which is a male, and the Berserker, which is also a male type character. But that I've seen kind of like the trailer for that before this episode was recorded, and I thought, no, that's not, there's too many waves of enemies. I don't like being swamped. I get easily swamped even on Assassin's Creed Valhalla. It just takes more than one. And then I can't cope because I can't block and parry and dodge and I just don't have to run. So I don't think I'd survive that game. But it's interesting. It's interesting how kind of like Norse realms have been used a lot in games such as Svartalfheim and Valheim, and the Heim word obviously comes up a lot in various places. Can I just check my wish list on my phone?
Yeah, I'm thinking as well, just thinking of, I guess, sequels that have come out recently. Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice, that whole duo is a really interesting one, given that it's, again, one of those sort of Norse-flavoured games. And I remember the first one, they really go ham into kind of like the experience of the game in terms of like the sound design, and they recommend you play it with headphones. And it got to a point where it was just so intense that I had to take the headphones off because I was just like, nope, I can't do this.
Okay.
And they tried to build up this sort of shamanistic, ecstatic trance style soundscape. And it's really intense. It's really cool and really well done. But it's one of those things that you have to be in the right mindset for. But it's really interesting how they've played with that kind of mythology and sort of ambient space that we associate with sort of vulva and CRS's
Yeah,
I remember reading lots when that came out because it got such attention because of its aspect of mental health and particularly schizophrenia, and how they actually got like a whole panel of people who have the condition to really make it realistic. And I remember seeing, again, by my brother, play it for a short while. I thought, no, I could probably do the puzzles, but the combat, I'm like, I remember seeing him face off against some what I think was meant to be a representation of the goddess Hel, but she was bald and looks more like a giant undead young woman than anything. I thought, no, I can't dodge that quick. I can't. I won't get to the end. I'll just have to find all the cinematic bits on YouTube and watch it and enjoy it that way. But of course, when Hellblade 2 came out, or Senua's Hellblade 2, that was set in Iceland. I thought, oh, Iceland again, an overlooked source of Norse history, and it just it oozes mythology in the sense of the kind of like the volcanoes, and they even have like the folklore of Iceland with fairies and whatnot. And they just, I would think if I was brave enough, I could play it, but I don't know if I could, especially that you mentioned about the headphones and the sound and the effect. I thought, I get scared easily, as you can tell.
Yeah, I got both of those games, the first one and the sequel, on sale recently. So they're on my very soon to be played list because I know they're quite important. But it's very amusing to me that these very serious games that tackle a very serious subject are by the same studio that made Devil May Cry, which is a very unserious series of games. So they're like, see, we can do this too.
That kind of makes sense. There are moments of the first Hellblade game where I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense that Devil May Cry is the legacy there.
Okay, I'll look forward to trying to find those moments.
We hope you have enjoyed the first part of this episode on Norse games and Vikings in games with special guests Luca Panaro and Emma Thompson. Please look for part two of this conversation, and we hope you can rejoin us in Valhalla soon. Thank you for watching and listening.